My name is William, and I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Phil and Dino, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Mike will read the preamble.
Hi, my name is Mike Brown. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Marty will read the steps.
My name is Marty. I am an alcoholic. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Sally will read the traditions.
Hi, I'm Sally. I'm an alcoholic. 12 traditions. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Luke.
Am I that tall? Thank you, Marty. Luke, alcoholic. All right, I'm an alcoholic. I don't know why I'm an alcoholic, I just know that I am. There's a lot of speculation as to why. I guess, you know, it seems kind of pointless for me to really analyze or interpret why I am, you know. I probably get it from my mother, who is definitely alcoholic. None of that's really that important to me, though. The fact of the matter is that I'm lucky enough to have acknowledged the fact that I am an alcoholic. And I don't really remember my first drink. I do know that I spent a lot of my childhood in my head, and that it was a long, long number of years before I started drinking. I didn't feel comfortable in my own skin until I started drinking. I couldn't really breathe easily, I don't think, until I started drinking. So I just remember when I found out that that was a solution for me. And when I found that out, there wasn't really a lot of progression, I guess. The dented hatchback that was my life, I pretty much just drove into a burning building. I started drinking heavily right off the bat and using a lot of other fun substances. And that became the solution to all my problems. And I remember it sort of like, you know, the morning after I was, you know, drinking or using drugs, whatever. It's just, it became this like impending doom of reality that I had to start running from. And I ran from it for years. It was a truly terrifying boogeyman that I tried to avoid at all costs. And the more and more I drank and used, the more scary that reality became. It was not long. I'd say I started drinking, you know, at a relatively young age, at the beginning of high school. And like I said, there really was no progression. I lasted about 6 weeks in 10th grade before my life came to a burning halt. And then began, you know, a slew of rehabs, methadone clinics, you know, streets, you know, weird places, and that was it, and that was okay, you know, that was all just on the exterior. I don't really, you know, I mean, if there's a bottom, I guess I sank like a stone right to it, but it wasn't really, you know, that intolerable. I mean, as long as I was heavily sedated on something, it's okay, you know. I don't really think I had a serious bottom. My bottom was when I was not, you know, intoxicated. It was the worst thing ever. You know, it's just it was really, really scary. But you know, I guess, you know, later on I sort of, you know, did hit more of a textbook bottom. I mean, you would, like, one would think that, you know, the depths I saw after, you know, and the levels that I hit, I would have, you know, been like, okay, I really need to get my act together. That's not the case. I really don't fear death much. I don't really fear much of anything, but I fear reality heavily. And I fear human interaction. I fear jobs. I fear leaving the house. I fear sunlight. I fear not having cable. I fear the telephone. I fear the mailbox. And I fear my neighbor who keeps watching me outside his blinds when I walk by his house. So, there's a lot of reasons to drink. I drank to be sophisticated. I drank to accommodate a good meal. I drank because I had nowhere to go and I was in an alley. I drank because I drank if I had a job interview. I drank if I had to, if I had to answer the phone, you know, things really, sometimes I just drank to keep it real, you know, I don't know. There's always an excuse to drink for me. I just knew that I needed it. I just knew that, sometimes alcoholics are just messy, you know, like, get, you know, they black out and drive around and crash cars and things like that. And I did all that. But I was actually pretty in pretty bad shape if I wasn't drinking. I was an alcoholic that really could not leave the house unless I was just annihilated. And then if I was annihilated, I could actually probably form sentences, talk to you, do things, tie shoes. But if not, I was a mess. I actually got a DUI sober because I had not had a drink in a while. I had slept through most of a Friday, and I rolled out of bed with the boogeyman in my face, and I'm like, wow, I have no more drugs and alcohol. I need to take care of this problem immediately. So I hopped in my car and proceeded to cut off a Los Angeles police officer, and going 60 miles an hour, so that was fun. So he pulled me over. He talked to me for a while and thought that I was completely wasted because I could probably not form a sentence, all because I really didn't have any drinks or drugs in me. So that's how badly I need a drink. So took that down to where I ended up finally getting sober. I relapsed. I came in and out of this program. I saw my first meeting by the time I was 16. I was no stranger to this, and it was abundantly clear that there was a solution here. I just wanted to not have to rely on a solution. I just wanted to be able to handle business myself. And there were a lot of things that got in the way of that. I'm not an alcoholic. I might have problems with harder drugs. I might just, you know, it's environmental. It's circumstantial. Maybe I'm just depressed. I've really tried all of that, and I've really tried to work it to my advantage, and I would not be here unless I ran completely out of ideas. So, luckily for me, I ran completely out of ideas, and I found myself 3,000 miles away from home in an ICU in Harlem, shaking, convulsing, going through alcoholic withdrawal, as well as a number of other things. I don't really have a burning bush either. Like I said, I really don't have a bottom. I mean, odds are I'll just die before that happens. I'm just lucky enough to be here now. And but I was with my nephew, and I had, you know, 10 days out of the hospital, and I was zipping up his coat. And he looked down and he said, "Uncle Lucas, why do your hands shake so much?" And I looked at him and I was like, man, it's the first time in my entire life I ever listened to anybody outside of my own committee of goofballs in my head. So it really kind of sunk through to me. And I was like, all right. So I went to a meeting. I started going to meetings at 7 a.m. because I couldn't sleep. And I basically just went in defeated. And that desperation I'm eternally grateful for, because I was able to transmute that into willingness, which I never fully had enough of. And I basically walked in with, you know, my heaping pile of junk and said, look, this is me. I'm a wreck. Tell me what to do. So, and if it weren't for that desperation, I still don't know if I would be here today. Probably wouldn't. I kept going to meetings. I've been very lucky with good sponsorship, and I just took the actions, very basic actions. I lived in my feet instead of my head, and I still kind of do that to this day. I simply, you know, I screw up a lot. You know, I am not perfect by any means. I'm completely fallible. However, I have the ability to rededicate myself to this solution. And just to do the fact that, you know, it has relieved me of the obsession to drink, has sparked my curiosity enough to continue it further on this path. Because it's really not about drinking, or not drinking. This is really a way of life. This has given me so much more than I could possibly have imagined. Every problem in my life right now is a quality problem. Because I never expected to have a life. I never expected to be here. I never intended to be here. I was hoping to die. Therefore, even the worst of problems really come across to me as a quality problem. I live in my feet. I simply go where my feet take me. I do service, and I continue to do the same habits that I learned that I needed to do when I was desperate enough. And I show up at meetings. I have sponsees. I go to Rikers Island for services. You know, all these things, it's just like, you know, I'll do whatever it takes. I mean, I sort of leave my mind behind because I'm nuts. And if I give it any airplay, I'm pretty much going to be screwed. Even from, like, you know, just ordering a coffee at Starbucks or something and, you know, just to greater life decisions. I really got to stay away from that voice in my head. And I'm just lucky to be here. And through service and through all of you, my life is amazing, and I really can't thank you enough. So thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Wendy.
Hi, my name's Wendy. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. If you're new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You are in the right place. It has been my experience that no one ends up in this room by accident. I found myself here many times over the years, and it took me a long time to realize that this was where I was supposed to be all along. So if you are here, there's probably a reason. That's just been what I've gone through. And my sobriety date is October 31st, 2006. I have a sponsor. Her name is Katie C. That's Bicycle Katie, for those of you who know all the Katie C's. I have a grand sponsor, and she has a sponsor, and I have a sober family, and I have a lot of sober friends for whom I'm extremely grateful. There's a lot of you in this room, actually. I'm so glad I get a chance to say this, that when I walk in, you might not even know who you are, but I see your face every week, and you make me smile, and I might not even know your name, but there's a lot of you that make a big difference in my life. So just a little bit about what it was like for me. Oh, and by the way, I asked Ava on my way up here if she had any words of advice, and she looked at my shoes, and she said, gorgeous. You have She did. This is true. She said, honey, you have on fabulous shoes. Forget it. So, and shoes are a part of my story. But so thank you, Ava. So a little bit about what it was like for me. I'm a consequence drinker from the very beginning. And, you know, I'd like to say this too. I had experiences in my childhood that were horrible. What I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is that a lot of people have experiences in their childhood that are horrible, but it doesn't give them a reason to behave alcoholically. So I respond to things like an alcoholic. That is something I have learned. It's a valuable lesson for me because I don't have to search for answers anymore. The answer is just that I'm an alcoholic. I respond to good things and bad things alcoholically. Consequence drinker from the beginning, immediately vomiting, blacking out, poor behavior, lying, anger, all these things were things that I experienced right away. I realized when I wrote my first step out, when I read it back, how incredible it was that all of these things happened from the age of 13, and it took me until the age of 34 to get in this room, and what a miracle it was that I actually was able to come here. And I just want to talk a little bit about what happened leading up to me getting here, and I hope that if anyone's new, if there's something that you can relate to, if you're a little bit confused about being here, you know, perhaps you can take some. Also, I'm aggressively recruiting sponsees. So if anyone, I am, so just see me later. So As I said, I got sober at 34 years old, and my sobriety date's October 31st, 2006. That is not the date of my last drink. The date of my last drink is September 8th, 2006. I was in a treatment facility until October 24th, and the day I got out of that treatment facility, I self-medicated with an anti-anxiety substance because, hello, I just got out of rehab. It's stressful, and it's true. And if you had seen my roots, you would have taken an anti-anxiety too. Okay? So, this is, you know, please, work with me. So, and October 31st is the day that I admitted that and the day I got honest. And that, to me, is the most important date. And I was able to go into a treatment facility. I was blessed to do that. I know a lot of people who get sober just, like, with life going on, and that always amazes me because I couldn't handle life. I had lost my job. I was a pound and a half. But I was still fabulous, and I remember walking into this very nice, it started off as a spa, then it was a treatment facility, then it was a rehabilitation center, and then it was a rehab, so I can say that today. I went to rehab. And I remember walking into this rehab, just a disaster. You know, I was completely messed up when I walked in, and I looked around this room where the intake, and I said, this is not going to work. And it was a Friday night, and they said, sweetheart, just go, you know, go in there. And I said, who are we getting out of bed? Because this is not going to work for me. And they just kind of looked, and they said, you know what, why don't you go take a seat? And it took me 45 days just to get my head straight. So I didn't actually hear the message of AA. Treatment for me was just to get to a place where I could function, literally where I could hear something. That's what it was for me. And where I heard the message of AA was actually in a halfway house. I, for some strange reason, took a suggestion from somebody to go get additional care after this treatment facility. And so I took my 34-year-old self and went and moved into this halfway house with young girls, and I slept in a twin bed in a room and shared and all these things that I thought would have been horrible. And, you know, it was humbling, but it was the best experience. And I wouldn't change it for anything. And, you know, I am the type of drinker who goes out for a drink after work, and, you know, drugs are part of my story. All I will mention is that I go out for a drink after work, and the next thing you know, it's 5 a.m, I'm tiptoeing and I'm rearranging my closet. So if you can relate to that, you know what I'm talking about. And if you can't, all that matters is I went out for a drink, and, you know, I don't end up going to bed until 5 a.m. It was out in California at this halfway house that I first heard the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started to listen. I was humbled, and, you know, it was funny. I mean, people would ask me where I was. I was consulting on the West Coast at Restoration Hardware on towel collars, and you know what? I had a great time. Like, it was just all about learning how to do an honest day's work, show up, follow structure. You know, I had the credit cards taken away. I rode around in the druggy buggy to go to movies with, like, a group, and we held hands. Like, it was just, oh. But, okay, that I'm not over, but I'm working on it with my outside help. So, but, you know, these were the things that I had to go through to get right-sized. And when I moved back to New York, I will tell you, God came into my life, and he made it all so easy. Like, I say a lot every day, acceptance is the answer to all my problems, because when I accept, I don't have any problems. When I came into AG, I came in at the suggestion of someone from Pacific Group, and they told me that the structure of the meeting was good. So if you are here and you're a little intimidated by the room, I can tell you from my experience that this room can become small, and there's so much good sobriety here, and you don't need to know everybody. Find one person. That's been my experience in joining this group. And what I do today is I have a sponsor. I call my sponsor. I have service commitments. I try to spend a lot of time. I have my new meditation, which is God comes in and Wendy goes out. And I must say that 100 times a day. But for me, it works. Because the less I'm the type of person who, you know, if I go out on a date with someone and I like them, I'm doing monograms the next day, literally. I'm like, we'll do the H in the middle and the D on the side, and we'll do it in a navy blue with a white border. I mean, that's, you know what I'm saying? Ava knows. And I know, y'all laughing, but you know. But you know, today I don't have to live in that craziness anymore. I can live in the moment. It's not all about me, and that's a real pleasant place to live. I think part of getting sober was that I felt like I was gripping onto the edge of a windowsill for so long, and my nails were scraping down the side, and the desperation. And for me, getting sober was letting go. And I have to remember that. And I tell you, the higher power connection that I have through working the steps, through my sponsor, Katie, through Sober Sisters, through the beautiful faces here, I mean, that, it makes things so easy. It's just so strange for me, who makes everything difficult and dramatic, and, you know, I can be sensitive, and all these things, it all kind of fades away. And I find that the greatest joy comes from just seeing a friend and being able to make a phone call for somebody else, or showing up to work and being of service instead of showing up to work and saying, what's in it for me? Huge difference for me. It used to be, what's in it for Wendy? When am I getting paid? What's my title? You're looking at me funny. Now it's, I go in, I put, and they were, and I go, because I was, yeah, and, but I go in and I put my head down and I do my job, and that's really all I'm there to do. I learned that here. I did not learn that on my own. You know, I learned how to be a good daughter and a good aunt. I mean, I have a nephew that my sister-in-law wants me to watch my nephew. He loves to see me when I come in the room. I couldn't show up when I was drinking. I mean, and even if I did, you wouldn't want to be around me. So I'm just, you know, again, I just want to reiterate that if you're coming from a place of confusion or sadness or loneliness, or even sometimes there's that real big excitement in the beginning, just please, you know, my experience has been that I've tried to harness it, walk through the fears, because the day-to-day life, and even if the fireworks don't go off, it's okay. I'll tell you, I have so much less to worry about and so much more to be grateful for. And in fact, I don't even worry about anything anymore. So I'm just appreciative for the group. Thank you, Debbie, for asking me to speak. And thank you again to all those people who, you know, fill my every day with just a lot of love and care. So I'm very grateful, and thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Howie.
Thank you. I wish I was 6'5". My name's Howie. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank my best friends in AA, Lenny and Ray, who came to support me tonight. And I want to thank Heidi for asking me. I was going to try and get out of this. I was playing phone tag with Heidi, and Heidi, I wanted to ask Heidi, do I have to wear a suit? Can I wear shorts? And I didn't get in touch with her. I saw her. I'm stuck wearing a suit. I went to meet Lenny, and Lenny says, I spoke to Heidi, you can wear shorts. I go, really? It's so great that Heidi asked me to come here and share my experience, strength, and hope. I want to thank everybody who welcomed us here. I'm so grateful being here. And being with everyone here. I grew up in, I'm not going to talk long. What time is this over, 11? Heidi asked me if I could speak for half an hour. I said, Heidi, I'm going to speak for 5 hours. I grew up in the South Bronx. And I always wanted to live in Queens. You know, not the North Bronx. I wanted to live in another borough. And, I'm a Jewish alcoholic. That's a lot different than, you know, Irish alcoholics, Indian alcoholics, Italian alcoholics. And ever since I remember, like Luke and Wendy were talking about, thank you for speaking, you guys. My last drink was October 4th, 1987. So for the newcomers, I'm coming up on 22 years. I had this figured out last week. October, I celebrate 22 years. And I can't believe I'm here. And Luke and Wendy spoke about the fear. I always had fear. Ever since I remember, terrible fear. Growing up in a Jewish alcoholic family, we lived next to the synagogue off Tremont Avenue. And My father was a drunk. And I went to the synagogue, and I had a good voice. So they asked me, Howie, you want to do the service on Saturday morning? And they gave us wine. This was like, you know, 1919. My daughter said, Daddy, you're going to speak. You have no teeth. Excuse my no teeth, but I had surgery on Thursday. And that was another thing I was going to tell Wendy. Wendy, I just had surgery. I can't speak. My daughter goes, you're going to go speak with no teeth? I go, it's no big deal, Rachel. I'm not that much better looking with teeth anyway, so it doesn't matter. I might look older with teeth. And I went to the synagogue, and they said, Howie, you're in charge of the wine. And they should never put me in charge of the wine. So I used to trade my wine for sponge cake. And I used to give all the kids the sponge cake, and they would give me their wine, and that was good. And I couldn't wait to, you know, for the Passover Seder. That was another thing. The Passover Seder was like 3 weeks from that day, and I had some more wine, and my mother says, Howie, you had enough? I said, just a little more, Mom. I was like 9. And I couldn't wait for the next Passover Seder. I said, Mom, aren't we having a Seder like tomorrow? No, Howie, that's it. You got to wait till next year. In my head, I'm thinking, I ain't waiting till next year. You know, it made my ears hot, my cheeks hot. I even loved my sister at the time for a couple of hours. And that was rough. So, and that's what I did, and I probably had an attention deficit disorder back in the 50s. I turned 61 in October, and I celebrate 22 years, so I came here with 38, and it was a struggle. And I used to come home, and I didn't know if my father was going to beat me up. And it was just me and my sister, my mother, and myself. And my grandmother lived across the hall from us. And my aunt lived next door. And I never wanted to come home because I didn't know if I was going to get beat up. So that was the fear. You know, like the boogeyman, afraid of the dark. I was always like that. So I killed the pain. And that's what I knew, kill the pain, have a drink. And I used to get deathly sick, 12 years old. In the schoolyard, hanging out, playing ball. I loved to play ball. I was never home. I probably had the intention. See, I just had it now, attention deficit disorder. But back then, in 1957, you were either dumb or smart. So I was in the dumb class. And I wasn't even the smartest one in the dumb class. And I'm going, how do these kids, like, know this stuff? Like, I used to read a book and forget what I was reading, and I couldn't remember things. And I remember just going through school like that and never paying attention, always thinking about the next place I'm going to be and looking out the window and thinking about going to Yankee Stadium and going to play ball and never thinking about school. And my father worked for the Daily News, and he had a route, and he used to deliver newspapers in Fordham Road in my neighborhood. And it was a big-time job, and I wanted to go on a truck with him to throw the papers off. And he says, I'm going to take you on the truck when you get a little bigger. And he took me on a truck. I must have been 11. And he took me down to the Daily News. This seems like 100 years ago. And I walked into Daily News, and it was total chaos. Guys running around with grease on their face, paper hats, and newspapers all over the place on tables. And the boss came over to this guy standing by the phone booth inside the Daily News on the main floor. And all the trucks are back then. And he says to this guy, he says, where is so-and-so? And he says, he's in the bar. He says, go and tell him to report to the floor. And I'm thinking, I'm standing there and I'm listening. I'm saying to myself, you can work here and drink? Man, I want to work here. That's it. And I wound up working there for almost 30-something years, 33 years. And that was it. It was all over. School was out the window. My whole idea in life and my thoughts and what I wanted to do, other, you know, kids want to go to medical school. They want to be a lawyer. They want to build buildings, construction. I wanted to work at Daily News, and it was a good job. But I knew my motive was I could work at Daily News and drink. That was my motive. So I went on to, I didn't pay attention in school because I was going to work at Daily News. And it got bad. Junior, after second grade, it was all downhill for me. Second grade, I did great. So my thought was I'll play center field for the Yankees when Mickey Mantle retires, and they'll call me up and they'll tell me, Howie, we need you to play center field. Or I'll just go get drunk. That was my thought. And I worked at Yankee Stadium when I was 14, and I used to see all the ball players coming in drunk, and I thought it was cool. Hangover the next day, falling out of the car. And I worked at the stadium for 4 years while I was going to school, and got thrown out of junior high school, fighting, drinking, sent to the Spofford Youth Center, and it got bad. And my whole thought was I'll go to DeWitt Clinton High School and play ball for DeWitt Clinton, and they'll call me to play for the Yankees. And my second year in DeWitt Clinton High School in the North Bronx, a lot of people know about DeWitt Clinton High School, they asked me to leave. And if you get thrown out of DeWitt Clinton High School, something's wrong. There were kids, there was two guys in my class, one was 20 and one was 22. And Mike Lightbulb had, he was 6'8", 22, with two kids, and he's telling me, he said, you know why you get thrown out, Howie? Because you always getting drunk and fighting with guys. I go, what are you talking about? You're here 8 years. And you got two kids, and you didn't graduate. He said, well, I'm graduating. I said, well, I hope so. You're here 8 years. So I got thrown out of DeWitt Clinton High School, and nobody gets thrown out of DeWitt Clinton High School. And I got thrown out, and I could tell you all the crazy stuff that went on in between that time and the time I went into the service, and it's all the same stuff, Drunk fights, get locked up, and I joined the Marine Corps, and I flunked the physical. I was drinking a lot, and I flunked the physical. They sent me to St. Albans Naval Hospital in Queens, and I had a kidney infection, and the captain came in, and I was 17 years old, and he told me, he says, Howie, you got to drink a lot of liquids, and it'll clear your kidneys up. He should never tell me that. And that's what I did, and I wound up in the hospital behind alcoholic poisoning, and 8 months later, I joined the Army, I want to back up a couple of years. My mother got pregnant, and I was 15. My sister was 14, and my mother got pregnant. So you know what goes on with kids, you know, when your mother... I told my mother, what do you mean you're pregnant? She was, I think, 40 years old. I go, Ma, 40 years old, you still do that stuff? I was so embarrassed. I said, Ma, do me a favor. Don't go out of the house until you have the baby. This is, you know, I'm embarrassed. And all the kids are saying, you know, Howie, your mother's pregnant. You know, I'm the father. So from 1962 to 1963, I fought every day. Every single day, I walked out of my house and went to the schoolyard two blocks away, had a fight every day. Guys didn't even want to bother with me because I was always fighting. So I fought him yesterday. And so I was proud of when my mother gave birth to my kid brother. And he's like 45 already. It's unbelievable. And the dysfunctional family, I spoke to him a couple of months ago. He's in North Carolina. But getting back to my drinking. So I joined the Army, and I go in the Army, and... In 1967, I get sent to South Vietnam, and I hook up with all the guys that are drunk. Guys are drinking. And I hook up with them, and it got bad. And I lasted 10 months, and I had a fight with a captain, and he didn't like me. I thought he didn't like me because I'm from New York. He was from Boston. That's another reason I know he didn't like me. And I was drunk a lot, and you had to be careful, you know, there's automatic weapons and... alcohol and automatic weapons don't go good together, and I pulled a pistol out on him, and I threatened to blow his head off, and you can't do that. It's not that you can't do that, you shouldn't do that. And they told me next time there's a war, we'll call you, don't call us. And they sent me to Korea, and I was in Korea near the DMZ in an artillery unit, and I got drunk there and got in trouble there, and eventually... a year and a half later, I did almost three years, and I got discharged, and I was always getting drunk all the time. We used to get drunk. It was like everybody got drunk, but I knew a couple of guys that didn't get drunk, and I didn't talk to them because I didn't trust them. Anybody who didn't drink, I didn't talk to. There was something wrong with them. So I got out, and I had a couple of relationships from the bar, you know, those bar relationships. Those last a long time, and the longest one I had was like seven weeks. And I asked three girls to marry. None of them wanted to marry me. I didn't know why. And I got out, and I got my GED, and I was going to school. I was driving a cab in the city, garage out of the Bronx, and about a year later, I get busted for second-degree murder. And I went away for 15 years. I did 6.5 years in, I don't say prison. I was in maximum security co-op. And I was in a diagnostic and treatment center, which is a nut house, for 19 months. And it wasn't that bad. I had a view of the Hudson River from Sing Sing. I had a good cell. I had a big cell. It was 12 feet, not 10 feet. 10 feet cells are small. And two extra feet. That's because I knew the rabbi's clerk. He got me a big cell, and it wasn't that bad. And it just wasn't that bad. And I got out. I got out, and I married a girl who I met in Queens in a bar, and we got married. And I was out on work release at a Sing Sing, and for the next 10 years I drank, and she left me. She was from Brooklyn, from East New York, raised old neighborhood, and she left me, and we married 2 years, 8 months, 7 days, and 6 hours. 6 hours were tough. And then I said, now I can drink like I want to drink, and I drank, and I lost my job. I had... got a steady job at Daily News. They took me back because I had worked there before. My name was on the list, thank God, for the union. And I said, I'm going to do the right thing. And I drank for the next 10 years. And I wound up in, you know, all the stuff that happens to us. Bellevue Psych. Bad. Detoxes. Hospitals. More jails. Brooklyn House of Detention. Rikers Island once. I think once or twice. I went to a car. I crashed 5 brand new cars in 5 years. Went to a windshield, duct taped my head because I knew I couldn't go to the hospital because I had no license. I was driving a Daily News truck with no license. I didn't tell them I had no license. I gave my license like 6 years ago. They didn't need my license again, but I had lost it, didn't tell them. And I crashed my wife, my present wife today, my current wife. Her first brand new car on East River Drive in a blackout. Went through the windshield, and I duct taped my head with duct tape. Because I remembered, like, when I was a kid, the seltzer truck used to run the football over in the truck in the street, and we used to get duct tape, put the pin in it, blow it up, and get the duct tape, and it was good for 2 more years. So I knew this from, you have to remember stuff when you're 12. And that's what I did. I'm walking around with duct tape on my head. And I had gotten busted again, and I was on parole. My parole officer said, you know, you're going away, Howie. I said, I don't care. And I didn't care. I just didn't care. I had my third DWI, and he said, it's mandatory, you're going to prison. And I didn't care. And my I'm going to talk about recovery now. My first sponsor, who he killed himself from this disease. He was in AA 2.5 years, and he went out, and he came back. I was telling Heidi the story, and he was a power of example for me because he got sober, and I didn't know what sober meant. I knew he didn't drink, and I was in bad shape. I lost my job at the Daily News, and that's another place. Nobody loses their job at Daily News. And I went to him, and I said, Jackie, please help me. I don't want to drink. And he told me, go to Means and don't drink. And I didn't want to listen, and 2 more years I drank until 1987. At the end of my drinking, I had a gun to my head, razor blades on the bed. I couldn't take it anymore. And I went into another detox, and I hit the bricks after the detox, and I was so scared. The fear, like Luke was talking about, the people, the telephone, the mail, everything. I got to talk to people. So I forced myself to go to meetings, and he told me to ask God to do for me what I can't do for myself and have the first step in my life. He says, that's the important thing. He says, having the steps in your life is the most important thing that you're going to be doing here, Howie, and do service. And I didn't know what he was talking about. He said, I want you to make coffee. So I did, and he lived in Brooklyn, and he told me to get another sponsor for my home group, Ry Harrison, in Westchester, and I did. And I went to meetings, I didn't drink, and for the first couple of months I wanted to drink. But I knew that if I drank, it was all over. And I celebrated 30 days and 60 days and 90 days, and I got my job back. And my life started getting a little better, and just going to meetings and asking for help and getting on. He told me God listens better when you're on your knees. And I had told him, Jewish guys don't get on their knees. He said, well, make believe you're not Jewish. He said, God listens better if you're on your knees. And then when he told me that, I did. I said, I need God to listen better to me because I'm very sick. And I didn't drink, and I went to meetings, and I just went to meetings, and then I did service. All through my AA life, I did service. I do service. No matter what you do, it's service. Setting up chairs, bringing a meeting into a detox or a rehab, whatever you're doing, and talking to a newcomer, that's all service. And I went to meetings. I didn't drink, And my daughter was born in 1992. We just went to St. Vincent's College to look for if she wants to go to St. Vincent's College. Imagine a Jewish guy going to St. Vincent's College. And she's graduating high school next year. And my daughter Jennifer was born in 1995. And she lived 2 months and she died. And I didn't drink. And my sponsor always used to tell me that about, you got to tell people that. I was sober almost 9 years, and my daughter Rachel was 2 and a half, then my daughter Jennifer was born, and she lived 2 months, and they didn't know what was wrong with her. She was in baby's hospital, and I was going to hospital with my wife every day to see her, and she died. She had a heart attack, and I just went to meetings, and I didn't drink, and I talked to my sponsor, and I really didn't think about drinking then. I just thought about going to meetings and doing what I always do. So I go to meetings and I don't drink and I carry the message to wherever I can. It don't matter. 3 years ago, this coming Christmas, my brother-in-law committed suicide, jumped off Tappan Zee Bridge, OxyContin and alcohol, and I tried to talk to him. He didn't want to hear it. And I told my wife, I said, Pam, I know the end of the movie. I've been to a lot of funerals in AA. I said, you know the end of the movie. She goes, Howie, I can't do nothing. And I tried to talk to him. He didn't want to hear it. And he went to the Tappan Zee Bridge. And that's how it ends for us. You know, drinking and drugging. It don't end nice. I sponsored 2 guys in 2004. Alcohol poisoning, dead. And one guy, they both knew each other so good. But the disease is so powerful that when we don't go to AA, the disease tells us we're okay. And I went through that without going to meetings, and I thought I was all right. And I thought I'll just have, like, you know, three doubles. And then, like Wendy said, and then what happens? You know, it's like 3 days later, and I don't know where I am, and I'm in a jail cell, and I don't remember why or what happened. And so the most powerful thing for me was going to meetings and not drinking. And my sponsor told me that it don't matter what happens, Howie, bring yourself to a meeting and help somebody else. He says, it's not all about you. He says, it's not what you've been through. It's what you can help somebody go through. And I never forgot that. And I was at a step meeting, early sobriety. I had a couple of years, and this guy was reading Practicing These Principles and All Your Affairs Will Change Your Affairs. I never forgot that. Because I was one of those guys who went to AA, and they read the preamble, because my job, my boss told me, if you don't go to AA, you're losing your job. So I went to AA, which I should have told you before, but that's that attention deficit. I went to AA, and they read the preamble. I didn't know what they were doing, and I thought it said no Jews or thieves. So my boss told me, I went back to the Daily News. He said, you go to the meeting, Howie? I go, Tommy, I can't go. He says, why not? I said, well, they read the thing before the meeting, and it said no Jews or thieves. As you know, I'm Jewish, and I got fired a few times for stealing here. You know I'm a thief. He says, Howie, you better go back and sit up front. I said, what are you talking about? So I went back to the meeting. I think I went twice. Two more times I went. I really didn't go. I went two more times to appease my boss. He said, you go to the meeting? I said, Tommy, I still don't understand what they said. It said, no dues or fees. I go, I must have been to the one where they said, no Jews or thieves. And that's when, you know, I really didn't want to go to AA because I, you know, I wasn't really as sick as you people. I was like on another, planet. So I kept going to meetings and my life got better. My life, it didn't matter what was happening. It really didn't, you know, physical stuff happens. I mean, Heidi called me up and she asked me if I could come and we were going to Aruba. You know, like, if I was drinking, I wasn't going to Aruba. And I had to fit this in between going to Aruba and all my doctor's appointments. So I went to meetings, and 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 something really happened. You know, I don't know what happened. You know, when I wrote a fifth step, and I told my sponsor, and I wrote a fourth step, And I remembered writing the fourth step and talking about the fear and when this guy tried to molest me and I went home and he took my jacket and I told my father, he asked me where my jacket was that my mother had just bought me on Fordham Road. I was 12 years old and I told him that this guy tried to, I didn't know what he wanted to do, but he took my jacket, he wanted me to come with him and I didn't go and I ran home and my father beat me up. And after that, I remember thinking, I'm never telling the truth ever again because the truth's going to get me in trouble. And that's all the stuff I drank over, all the shame and guilt to kill the pain. And like my sponsor told me, he says, Howie, you never have to live like that ever again the rest of your life, one day at a time. And I didn't get that one day at a time. I thought, like, man, maybe you can drink after 3 years or maybe after. I thought some people in AA drink like they're allowed to drink. That's how sick I was. I thought one part of it, we used to go to the dining room. I saw people like with 8 months up at the counter. I thought they were drinking. People at the table were eating pancakes. I said, I want to sit at the counter. And somebody said, why do you want to sit at the counter? He said, because they can drink at the counter. So it's so good to be here, and I love all you guys, and I'll see you in 2010 in San Antonio. Thank you.